Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we'll hear from some people here in Iowa, some of the people in some of the worst hit areas of flooding in western Iowa. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court is in the middle of its term. Joining us, as he has for years in the past, Todd Pettis, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law, to walk us through some of the highlights of cases that have already been heard, perhaps not decided yet, or in cases yet to come. Todd Pettis, welcome back to our program.
Thanks so much for inviting me back.
We have a lot on our docket, so let's get right to it. A case that deals with excessive fines. Tell us about that.
Right, excessive fines. So the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution bans excessive fines, and we'll get to that text here in a second. So let me tell you just a little bit about the facts of this case. They're pretty simple. There's a guy named Tyson Timms in Indiana who had struggled for a long time with a drug addiction. His father died. He got a lot of life insurance money, and he used some of that money to buy a Land Rover, which cost a little more than $40,000. He continued to use drugs, and one day he sold drugs. He sold heroin to an undercover officer. He's arrested. He's charged with a drug crime, and he's sentenced to about a year of home detention and a few years of probation. The state then said, we're going to take the Land Rover. We're going to seize it, so $40-something thousand dollars. And that's part of what really has been a national trend over the last decade or two, is government funding or funding for government services at all levels of government has, you know, been cut. Mm-hmm. There's been a turn to fines and fees and forfeitures as ways of just funding government.
And I'm assuming this Land Rover was used in some way in the crime.
It was, and it had to have been for them to seize it. And he used the Land Rover to drive from point A to point B in order to be able to sell it. So he used it in the commission of a crime, and that triggered Indiana's forfeiture laws, as it would in, you know, most if not all states. Hmm. He thought that this was wildly disproportionate, and that gets us back to the Eighth Amendment, which bans excessive fines. The Eighth Amendment says you can't have cruel, unusual punishment, and you can't have excessive fines. And the general notion there is there's got to be at least a rough proportionality between the seriousness of the crime and the value of the thing that they're going to, the amount of the fine or the value of the property that the government's going to take. And he said, well, look, the drug crime that I was found guilty of, the maximum fine I could have paid was $10,000.
But you took my $40,000.
You took my $40,000 Land Rover that, yeah, I bought with the money after my dad died. And he went up through the Indiana court system, and the Indiana Supreme Court said, we don't have to obey the Eighth Amendment. Now, a lot of your listeners will know, but some won't. To understand why Indiana would take that position, the Bill of Rights, which contain the first 10 amendments, which contains so many of the rights that, you know, you can't, even if you haven't studied law a day in your life, you know about them: free speech and unreasonable search and seizure, establishment of religion, cruel and unusual punishment. All of those rights, initially, when we started as a country, they applied only to the federal government. We had created this, the states already existed. We create this brand new federal government. There's a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety about how abusive this new government might be. So we spell out this Bill of Rights, mm-hmm, describing things Congress can't do. Well, after the Civil War, we get the 14th Amendment, which has a due process clause in it. And as we get into the 1900s, the Supreme Court started kind of digging deep into what that 14th Amendment due process clause might mean. And through some complicated legal maneuvers, the court started finding one by one that different provisions of the Bill of Rights also apply to the states. And so today, for example, the free speech clause applies to the state. So the state of Iowa would be violating your federal First Amendment speech rights if it puts duct tape over your mouth and doesn't let you say whatever you want to say. Okay. Well, the Eighth Amendment excessive fines clause, we had never had a Supreme Court case before saying whether the states had to obey it, which is pretty remarkable.
Surprising.
It is surprising. We got this far into our nation's history without the court ever answering that question. A little context, it's only been 10 years or so that we've known for sure that the Second Amendment protecting firearms rights, that applies to the states. And so some of these things like speech and religion, that's been in place now as a matter of law for half a century or more. We know the states have to obey it. But we didn't know about the excessive fines clause. The Indiana Supreme Court said, we're a sovereign state. Supreme Court hasn't told us that we have to, so we're not going to. We can do what we want so far as the Eighth Amendment is concerned. And the Supreme Court unanimously disagreed and added the excessive fines clause to the very long list of provisions of the Bill of Rights that the states have to obey.
Mm-hmm. So now in any future cases, here in Iowa, for instance, do prosecutors, the judges have to pay attention to, do they have like a chart that says how much they can take away from a person?
There's some rough standards, but they're very rough. The constitutional law just speaks about gross disproportionality. It gives a lot of deference to lawmakers and so forth to decide what's appropriate. It's not going to have a revolutionary impact because every state in the country, including Iowa, also has an excessive fines clause in its state constitution. Mm-hmm. And the states have long had an eye on what the federal rules are under the similar clause in the federal constitution and use that as a benchmark for interpreting their state constitutions. So in Iowa, for example, we're already pretty much there where the Eighth Amendment places us. But now, as a matter of law, we know that the Eighth Amendment applies as well.
Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law walking us through some of the highlights in this year's Supreme Court term. They're in the midst of that. Let's talk about one that you pointed out that involves the placement of a huge stone cross that has been on what, public lands for years?
Yeah, it's called the Peace Cross. It's just a few miles. If you drive northwest out of Washington, D.C., away from the Capitol, you don't have to drive for very many minutes, and you get to Bladensburg, Maryland. And just as you cross into the city limits, amidst very heavy traffic, there's a, you know, you look at the map of it, and it's one of these things where you marvel at the engineering, all these multi-lane roads coming together, swirling around. And right in the middle of that is a 40-foot stone cross. You don't have much time as you're driving, whizzing by in the traffic, you know, to pause and take a look at it. But as you drive by, you can see that where the arms of the cross meet, there's the American Legion symbol. And if you were to find a place to park and kind of dodge the cars and go out and then stand at the base of this, you'd see that at the very bottom is a plaque listing the names of 49 local soldiers who died in World War I. And it is in their memory that this cross was first established nearly a century ago, way back in 1925, with the financial support of American Legion. But yes, it stands on public property, and the state government maintains that property. They maintain the cross. You know, if there were to be a little chip in the cross or something, the state would go in and fix it. And a lawsuit has been filed by a group called the American Humanist Association, whose motto I've learned in preparing for your show is good without a God. And so this is part of their mission to kind of go out.
They want
strict separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. So to have a state maintaining this symbol that is at the heart of Christianity is inconsistent with their own views, so they have filed this lawsuit. And legally, what's interesting about this is it's the Establishment Clause that's at issue. That's the First Amendment. And we've known for a long time, the Supreme Court said in the early 1900s, that the Establishment Clause applies to the states, following up on the case we were just talking about. And so Maryland has to obey the Establishment Clause. They can't establish a religion. And what's really remarkable today about the Establishment Clause is what great disagreement there is among the justices about what the right questions are to ask in an Establishment Clause case. I don't think there's any other area of law having to do with individual rights where there's greater disarray about just exactly what we're looking for.
Depending on how you phrase the question will determine your outcome.
Absolutely. And so just real quickly, some examples. Some justices want to ask about coercion. Is the government coercing you to do anything? Well, the answer to the question there at the cross is going to be clearly no. Maryland's not forcing you to do anything with respect to religion. You're just driving by and you see this thing. So if you're asking the coercion question, as several justices do, this is absolutely fine. Some justices would ask about endorsement, meaning is this communicating to you some kind of a message from the state of Maryland that here in Maryland or here in Bladensburg, we're Christians. And if you're not Christian, you're really not one of those. Mm. Some justices don't want to ask that question, but a number of the justices do. And so then you end up looking at things like context. So we have cases where there'll be a nativity scene set up, and whether it's on city grounds, like a public park or here in Iowa City down in the Ped Mall, wherever, Des Moines or the Capitol grounds, they set up a nativity scene. And you ask, does that violate the Establishment Clause? Well, from the coercion point of view, it's totally fine. from the endorsement point of view, it depends. And what it depends on is there anything else around there? Is it just the nativity scene? Well, that's probably sending a message about Christianity. Is Santa and the reindeer, are they kind of set up around there too as a holiday display? Well, then it's okay. And there's a number of Supreme Court cases that have been decided on those grounds. You know, what's in the area? What do you see?
This one has been argued before the court, but not decided?
It has been argued, but not decided. That's right. It was argued on February 27th. It will get a decision probably in June, close to the end of the term. I don't think there's any way in the world the court's going to declare that cross unconstitutional. They're going to uphold it. I'd stake my life on that.
Okay.
The question is, okay, so I have no doubt that this court is not going to declare that cross unconstitutional. What's interesting legally is, will the court, with now some new members, will they be able to finally form a consensus about what the right test is? And that test could have really important implications for other kinds of settings, like Ten Commandment displays.
Or nativity scenes.
Nativity scenes, prayers in legislative assemblies, all kinds of things.
Okay, Todd Pettis with us going through some of the highlights in the current Supreme Court term. Double Jeopardy. No, not the game show. It's a clause in the U.S. Constitution. We're going to be talking about it legally here. Double jeopardy in its legal sense, Todd, it bars you from being prosecuted after an acquittal or a conviction a second time and prohibits multiple punishments for the same offense. Now, there's a double jeopardy case before the Supreme Court.
There is, and it's an interesting case, and it poses an interesting problem. And kind of depending on your mood or depending on which way you look at it, you can kind of maybe find yourself coming down on either side of this question. But just to underscore what you said by way of introduction to what the Double Jeopardy Clause does, in general, if the state wants to prosecute you for a crime, or the federal government wants to prosecute mm-hmm. you for a crime, they get one shot. And so if they think they've got enough evidence, they have a trial and the jury acquits you, the jury finds you not guilty, and then later the government comes along and they find even better evidence or DNA evidence comes along and says, ah, now we got you, it's too late. They get one chance, okay? And that's because of the Double Jeopardy Clause. So you can be charged one time for a crime. Now, the issue that's come up here is a man in Alabama named Terrence Gamble. He's pulled over for a broken headlight. Police smell marijuana, so they search the car, and they find that he has a gun. Turns out he's a convicted felon. He had, from some years back, a second-degree robbery conviction. And at the state level in Alabama, it's a crime to be a felon in possession of a firearm. It's a crime here in Iowa, too, by the way. And so the states prosecute him. And he gets a sentence of something like a year in prison. Then the federal government comes along and says, you know what? We at the federal level have a law that makes exactly the same thing a crime. Federal government says it's a possession for a convicted felon to have a gun. So same gun, same car, same day he's caught with it, same underlying felony conviction, the robbery conviction from some years back, and the feds come along and prosecute him, and he gets a few years added to his sentence, essentially. You know, he's going to go from state prison to federal prison because the feds give him a three-year sentence. And he says, now this violates my double jeopardy rights. Mm. You can't come after me twice for the same crime.
One from a federal angle, one from a state angle.
Yes, exactly. And so it really makes us think, what is at its heart, what's the double jeopardy clause about? Is it the notion that when I do something wrong, I'm kind of exposed to legal liability one time? Or is it instead some kind of more government-specific notion that, well, when I do something wrong, a given government can only come after me one time, but if there's a line of governments waiting their turn to get a crack at me, they can all take their crack. The Supreme Court has said for a century and a half now, under something called the Separate Sovereigns Doctrine, that this is okay. The states can take their turn, the feds can take their turn, and it's not a problem. And he's there at the court asking the justices to abandon that rule.
What are the broader implications of the decision yet to be made?
It extends in areas that you might not anticipate. And so, for example, with respect to Robert Mueller's investigation of the President Trump's campaign and finances and so forth, and there's always the possibility of presidential pardons. Okay. Well, if the president were to issue a pardon, that would solve trouble for a person with respect to their federal charges, but it still would be possible for the state to say, well, when you engage in this particular set of financial dealings or whatever it was, you violated the state law too. under the separate sovereigns doctrine, which again, the court's being asked here to overturn, but has been in place for about a century and a half, the state could say, well, the president may have pardoned him, so this person is no longer facing federal punishment, but the state of New York or what have you, we've got our own justice system, we are our own sovereign, we'll come after you.
Mm-hmm. Any indication on how the court might rule here?
Because the doctrine has been in place for about a century and a half, it faces, Mr. Gamble, I think, faces a very steep hill. Justice Kagan and others, just based on that ground, you know, wow, 30 separate justices have signed on to this rule. So you really have got a heavy burden of persuasion.
But as a justice, we're not, you spin it out to other wider implications. As a justice in the Supreme Court, are you thinking about those implications? Are you thinking about the Mueller investigation? Should you be?
Well, you don't have to. You might be, but you don't have to be. I'll give you just a very quick example. Justice Alito asked a question. He said, suppose that there's some terrorists who murder some Americans abroad, and those terrorists are charged with a crime in their home country, and the judicial proceedings are okay from a due process point of view, and they essentially get a slap on their wrist for murdering these Americans who are traveling abroad. Are you saying that here in America we couldn't charge those terrorists too? We have to say, oh, they've been charged once. They've gotten a slap on the wrist. So you start thinking about hypotheticals like that or civil rights laws, and this has come up in a number of civil rights settings where someone will do something, you know, there'll be assault on minority poll workers or something, and the state goes after them, but there's no heavy punishment.
Mm-hmm.
On Mr. Gamble's theory of the double jeopardy clause, we'd say, well, you've already been exposed to, you know, legal jeopardy as a result of that one wrong act, all the other governments in the world now have to stand back? Or can we say, no, those governments can line up and each take their crack at you?
Okay.
So I think when you put together those, the history of the doctrine, those broader implications, I think this doctrine is probably going to stand.
So many fascinating cases. Talking with Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law about U.S. Supreme Court cases. We have just a few minutes left. Perhaps we can quickly include one more that you pointed out of interest. This is one we've heard about in the news, the question about the upcoming census in 2020 and whether to insert a question about citizenship.
Yeah, for most of this country's history, when you got your census form, just to back up, every 10 years we have a census to figure out how many people we have living in different areas. And a lot rides on this. The strength of a state's representation in the House of Representatives, so how many members you get in the House depends on how many people live in your state.
Iowa, for instance, has gone from, I think, 11 districts at one point down to our currently 4 districts.
Right. So you lose population, you lose representatives. That, in turn, determines your electoral college vote. So the strength, how much power do you have a state in choosing the president? Billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of federal funding, and at the state level funding too, depend on how many people live in a given jurisdiction. So there's a lot of people who have a strong interest in making sure that the count is accurate. The Trump administration has announced that they're going to ask a question on the census about citizenship, and a lot of states have sued, including the state of Iowa, have sued and said, you can't do this. Why can't you do this? It's a range of different things. A lot of it has to do with legal process. You know, there's a statute that says if you're going to add a question to the census, you have to give Congress notice 2 or 3 years in advance. There's another statute that says if you're going to use the census as an opportunity to get information about a given thing, like citizenship or anything else, you can only do it if you can't get the data somewhere else pretty easily. And these states, Iowa and others, are saying this data is already available. You don't need to ask it on the census. And the reason those laws say that is there's an awful lot of social science that shows that if you ask about citizenship, minority recipients of the census form and non-citizens who get counted too. We're not counting citizens. It doesn't matter whether
just
you're a citizen.
Who is within these
how
borders?
How many human beings do we have within our borders? That's the
okay.
question.
Right.
Okay. How many persons do we have? That's the language of the Constitution, how many persons. So that's the nature of the challenge. I'll tell you, because I know time is running short, Iowa Public Radio, you guys have up on your website a really terrific piece of reporting that lays out all of the emails and phone conversations and so forth, or a lot of it anyway, that's kind of giving rise to this controversy. So just in the interest of time, I'll just say, if someone wanted to Google it, the name of the story that's up on your website is called How the 2020 Census Citizenship Question Ended Up in Court.
Okay.
Okay. It's a great story and kind of and lays it all out for folks.
Todd Pettis, in the last couple of minutes, I want to ask you quickly about a couple of items that involve the U.S. Supreme Court in the news. President Trump has two appointees on the U.S. Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. They were expected to bring what some saw as a conservative revolution to the high court. Are there indications this is happening?
There aren't yet. And I think there's two reasons. Number one, Justice Kavanaugh has been in place for such a short period of time that you just can't make any conclusions yet, I think, about trends. But the other thing is there's some indication that Chief Justice Roberts has himself shifted a little bit to the center from kind of trying to protect the Supreme Court from an institutional point of view. You know, they've had a pretty rough ride. From a claim of partisanship, and with national politics and presidential politics and partisanship and divided Congress and threats of shutdown and so forth, there are a lot of reasons to think that Chief Justice Roberts is really trying to hold his branch of government, if I can put it that way, the judiciary, a little bit apart, trying to be above it all. And the one way you do that is you minimize the number of really controversial rulings you hand down. So the Supreme Court has not taken a large number of really hot cases. There are some interesting, important cases, but not a large number. And even on some of the ones that they have taken, there's indication that Chief Justice Roberts may have slid a bit to the left just to kind of hold the status quo in place, at least for the time being.
Okay, I don't know if you can do this in less than a minute, but we're hearing now about President Trump's order to finance a southern border wall with an emergency declaration, hearing claims that it's unconstitutional, it violates the separation of powers. Will this eventually be decided by the Supreme Court?
If the Supreme Court wants to take the case, it will be. There absolutely will be judicial proceedings about it. People who are harmed by it, you know, if the wall is put up through their property, they'll be suffering an injury that would enable them to get in court. There's statutes that speak to when the president can and cannot use emergency power. So there absolutely will be litigation. Whether the Supreme Court chooses to take the case when it gets up that high will be up to the court, because for the most part, they've got control over their own docket. If you lose at a lower federal court or in the Indiana Supreme Court case, to go back to the first case we talked about, you can ask the Supreme Court to take your case, but it's ultimately up to them.
Okay, Todd Pettis, we have to go, unfortunately. Wow, thank you for walking us through several important Supreme Court news items and cases. Todd, we'll look forward to having you back on the program.
It's a lot of fun for me. Thank you very much.
Todd Pettis, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. When we come back, we'll hear from some of the people in the worst hit areas of flooding in western Iowa. About half of Iowa's counties have been given an emergency proclamation. We'll hear about that and some personal stories when we come back. Yeah, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.